Welcome.
It's actually in the ring.
For the record. Let's convene the Thursday, June 3rd edition of the Late Meetings Public Safety Subcommittee. We are in a work session for House Bill 2535 relating to firearms. I think everyone in the room has heard as much about this as they ever want to hear. So we will move quite quickly through this. There are certain procedural motions that we must make. I am not going to accept public testimony. This is a workshop session. And I think that all the stakeholders have done an excellent job in allowing this to come back to committee to make some technical amendments that truly do improve the bill. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hannon?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2535 as amended back to the Subcommittee on Public Safety.
Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Mannix?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we withdraw the amendments previously added to House Bill 2535 in the committee during our prior action.
Any discussion? Any objections? So moved.
I move that we adopt the A23 amendments to House Bill 2535A engrossed.
Would you like to discuss any of the changes that were made in that just for the...
If I may, I will describe the four essential changes. What the A23 amendments do is they maintain the prior technical amendments, but we tried to incorporate everything into one document to make sure that everything is copacetic. So the prior technical amendments are maintained with one change, and that is a correction as to the description of the locked storage devices and that sort of language. So there was a clarification based on the criticisms from Representative Patridge as to the language about secure storage devices and locked storage devices. Those are included in these amendments. In addition, there was clarification that at a gun show, if you were delivering a firearm to a gun dealer, well, obviously gun dealers are licensed by the federal government, you don't need to do a background check to deliver the firearm to or transfer the firearm to the gun dealer. There was a technical clarification that the state police requested that everyone agree to that changes one of the phrases here that is describing transferring firearms in order to accommodate federal law so that the state police background check could be conducted in conjunction with federal law. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that I've covered three technical amendments. There may have been a fourth that's slipping my mind at this point, but I don't think so.
We'll have a staff report, and perhaps Mr. Nicewinder can address any other technical amendments that maybe slipped in your mind, as well as fiscal impact.
Chair Wessel, committee members, in follow-up to what Representative Mannix has said, there's only one other change that I'm aware of, and that is on page 2, line 20, and that is where the request of state police that a language has been amended to state that the approval number that's provided is a permit valid for 24 hours, and that's just a technical amendment that allows them to comply with the federal guidelines that allow them to do background checks. It has to be a permit or a license that they're doing the background check on. So that's the only other change that I'm aware of. In relationship to the A23 amendments, they have no impact on the fiscal impact statement that was issued previously, and as such, the bill appropriately provides for the other funds expenditure limitation necessary for the state police to implement the program.
Okay. Could I have a motion to adopt the A23?
I believe you have it, but in case you don't, I give it to you now, sir.
We do. We've got an analysis of that, a fire report from Representative Mannix. Any discussion on the A23s? Any dissension on the A23s?
Oh, no.
Not on the A23s. The A23 amendments are incorporated into House Bill 2535. So moved.
I move that House Bill 2535 be sent on to the full committee on ways and means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Appreciate your motion, Representative Mannix. House Bill 2535 has been moved to the full committee. House Bill 2535 as amended has been moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is Senator Burdick in? Senator Burdick, do you have anything you would be comfortable in saying or not saying, or you've been instrumental in this long trail of tears.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jenny Burdick, State Senator from District 6. I just wanted to commend this subcommittee for its work. I reluctantly cast a no vote on this bill when it was last in committee because of my concerns over enforcement. And I felt reluctant about that because it is otherwise a very fine bill. In the ensuing couple of weeks since we last acted on this, I've worked with the law enforcement community who have been allies of all of us as we work this bill through the process. And they have addressed my concerns about enforcement. So I'm very pleased to be back in support of this bill. And again, want to commend this subcommittee for its work on this measure. And I urge you to send it on. It's merry way.
Senator Burry, I appreciate very much you being here and your support of this bill. I don't want to cut off the beta questions, but we have a very full agenda today, including two budgets we have to work on. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
We appreciate your support. I'd also like just generally to ask the community, the stakeholders out in the audience, that they, all the people who worked so hard on this bill. I mean, I think everyone really deserves a lot of credit for trying to hold this house of cards together with Band-Aids and bubble gum, and by golly, you've done it, and I'm proud of each and every one of you. I assume if I asked you if you all supported this bill, the appropriate physical motion would be, let the record show that every individual in the world is nodding their head. Hold on. Senator Hannon's going to get this. There are several nods going the other way. Anyway, we have a motion to move House Bill 2535 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any notes? One note. Senator Hannah. Bill passes, and we move House Bill 2535 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
So moved. You don't sit on the full committee. I am the only sitter on the full committee. I am thrust into the front lines again. I don't get enough money for this, so I will carry it to the full committee. Do we have a volunteer to carry it on the Senate floor?
Senator Burdick might want to try.
That's an excellent idea, and Representative Mannix should carry this on the House floor. One down, 300 to go. Okay. We will close the work session on 2535, and we will open the work session on Senate Bill 5529, the military budget. Do I have a report from staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have in front of you a yellow memorandum which summarizes the action that was taken by subcommittee in February related to this budget. You approved the Oregon Military Department budget, increasing the governor's recommended budget to fund the Youth Challenge Program, Tuition Assistance Program, Military Museum, and Air National Guard position. The budget is now back before you to move the budget to full ways and means with some technical adjustments. And I'm going to walk you through those now. I'm recommending that you approve the Youth Challenge Program at a total of $5.6 million. That is a reduction from the amount that you had previously approved because there have been some revised estimates that lowered the general fund need and increased the other fund estimate for the average daily membership rate and school lunch program money that the agency will receive. So that now is $660,000 in general fund and $1.3 in other funds. So I'm recommending that adjustment. And 49 FTE become permanent, which is in the duration from the previous program. I'm also recommending that you approve a shift of $28,591 from services and supplies to personal services in the museum curator package to accommodate a position classification change from administrative specialist to program technician position. And then to approve a permanent program technician position to administer the tuition waiver program that had not been included in the previous motion, but it is needed to carry out the program. And then finally, the subcommittee requested a budget note to report the effectiveness of the tuition assistance program in increasing that tuition funding and report back the effectiveness of that to the subcommittee, and that's the budget note.
You done?
That's it.
Sounds pretty good. Representative Trader.
What was the comparison? You indicated the youth challenges changed. What was the previous level of funding?
It's about $600,000
higher.
In your on your spreadsheet that's attached to your yellow page, the second page there, the last page shows the subcommittee adjustments. You had approved $1.178 million. That's being reduced by $518,958, and it's being adjusted in the other subs category to reflect the increased estimates on the ADN and lunch school lunch program.
Representative Merrick.
So I understand they'll still be able to provide the same level of programs, it's just the funding source shift.
That's correct.
Very well. Thank you. You need a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Are there any other discussions? I mean, the thing I hate to do is rush these work sessions. Seeing no other questions and having thoroughly examined this subject, I would appreciate a motion very much, Representative Manning.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the LFO recommendations. First one, the supplemental recommendations presented today by LFO.
Any discussions? Any nay votes? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Manning.
Thank you. I had a discussion. I was curious about at least the adopting a budget note which encouraged the military departments to work with the Department of Corrections to see if the Department of Corrections could provide some of their prison work crews to assist in continued renovation and improvement of military department facilities. Having the military department use their on hand, and then having the Department of Corrections be encouraged to stretch their capability as best they can to assist the military department. I don't know if LFO staff had a chance to discuss that with Colonel Caldwell today or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, the military department faxed to me some language for a budget note, but I believe that this budget note would be more
in the DOC budget.
In the DOC budget, in the context of what's happening with the overall program.
Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to make the motion on the bill.
I would accept that, but first let me admonish all committee members that if you want to have some budget notes presented, I would ask humbly that I have the opportunity to see them before I hear about them in a work session.
In fact, I had assumed it had been brought to you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for that.
I would assume that all of these have been brought to me, but you know how this is the military. Things happen.
Well, and Mr. Chair, local co-chairs have to have a budget note, too.
I understand that. And apparently that had not happened.
Having said all of that.
Apparently it didn't happen because staff had already put the kibosh on it by saying it had to go to corrections. So you'll see it when it comes to corrections.
We got lots of time.
In other words, you don't see things you don't need to see.
I appreciate being protected and sheltered like that. Yeah, our lives are intense. It's our job. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Has the committee heard an affirmative action report from the military department in any previous meetings?
I will allow that we heard this budget. This is our first budget that we heard come January 11 or 12.
February 2nd.
And I guess I'd have to ask staff if we did. I am not recalling them, Senator Gordley. I could be very mistaken.
I know that there is a report attached to the workbook, but
I'm very interested in hearing what progress is being made to diversify the department. Issues have been raised in the past, and I'd just like to know what progress you're making.
Clark Caldwell, if you would be good enough.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Senator Gordon, the reference in the tab, and I'm sort of going to look for it here real quick, there's, in our book, there is a summary of the questions that you're asking in general, and I can't quote the exact numbers, but essentially 4 years ago, we were considered on the governor's list of non-compliant agencies as, I think they called it, a dirty dozen list. I don't know what it was. We were in the bottom 10. We've since come off of that list with the diversification efforts that we've done. And so Ray has very aptly pointed me to the right page. It's under tab 12, number 1. And we have detailed out the overall agencies, both women, persons of color, and persons with disability. The total numbers, as of, if you look at from 97 to 98, in people with disability, we've gone from 17.4% to 6.7%, totals 265 up to 298. Persons of color, 15% to 26%, and women, 39% to 55% in the categories that are covered in this budget. The entire agency report is not something that we put into the budget. However, and by that I mean this is the part-time traditional National Guard. We have made strides. We're meeting the federal standards that are given to us by the National Guard Bureau. However, it's still something less than what we would desire to have at this point. But we have made extreme efforts at this subject matter over the last 4 years, and I think we've shown a steady improvement. We've not dropped. We've done nothing everywhere, every category we've raised. So we have been working diligently. There's a lot of that the last time we sat before this committee, I guess it was 2 years ago.
Okay. I appreciate having that brief presentation, Mr. Chair. As has been noted, the department was on the governor's non-compliant list. The department is now off that list and is making some progress. But these are issues and an area that we need to continue to monitor. I commend the department for the progress that you are making, however.
Thanks, sir.
Please, Chairman.
Senator Hannah.
Colonel, the 14 persons of color, why isn't that identified as minority persons of minority rather than a loose definition of what color is? Does that pertain to Asians? Does that pertain to Hispanics? Does that pertain to other races?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah, that's correct. It's not divided up in that finite of detail. It's just one broad category. If I'm not mistaken, and I don't want to sit here and tell you that I'm the expert in this field, because I'm not, but this is in compliance with the standards that are set forth to us to work with. We didn't create that category. We used the category as defined by us from DAS.
Well, the only reason I raised the issue is that Mike Jaundice, what types of minorities are actually being hired?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah, you're absolutely correct. It doesn't give that sort of detail. If you were looking at Hispanics versus blacks versus Asians, again, I'm going to reflect one broad statement here, and that is, again, we meet the federal standard is very much similar to the state standard, but it is more finite in that they want that exact, the numbers of Asians, African-Americans, Hispanics, and right on through the line. And again, the standard that we have on the federal government statistics are based on the state's percentage of that group. I can tell you unequivocally that we are below where we should be with Hispanics. We do not have the we do not meet the federal guidelines in Hispanic recruitment for our traditional National Guard right at the present time. We're not very much below it, but as the Hispanic population has grown, it's become increasingly difficult for us to keep up with that number. We have not done the proper job there. We're making efforts to do that, and we've hired Hispanic recruiters to go out and try to work in Hispanic communities, and we've done the same in the black African-American areas, particularly in the Portland area, but that's primarily where the population exists. Our biggest problem in the Portland area, quite frankly, is that we've been limited. We can't get into the high schools, as you may well know, but it does create an issue there. We think we've got a resolution for that. We're working with the Portland School Board, and we hope to have that completed and executed on an agreement with the Portland School District as the new board takes over in July. We've been working for about a year on that. So we're very hopeful that that's going to work out, and our negotiations and discussions have gone very, very well. Okay. So I think we're going to break open that piece of the pie that will help us directly in the African American community.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you for the question.
Well, thank you.
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill to the full committee on Ways and Means to reduce tax recommendation as looked up by the subcommittee.
We have a motion to move the Senate Bill 6529 to the full committee with due draft recommendation. Any discussion?
There is discussion. It's at the end of the table, but it's not pertaining to the bill.
How do you know?
Excuse me, Gracie. I mean,
it's not pertaining to the motion. Well, it could be pertaining to the motion. I stand ahead. Any discussion?
Any dissension? Seeing none, Senate Bill 5529 is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I had to sneak that in before Schrader got back. That way, you can answer that question. Carrier.
Mr. Chairman, I'll volunteer to carry it on the House floor.
Hold on. Senate bill, we're going down the line. You got the gun bill to carry. I can carry the military.
I'll carry the other gun bill.
No. In the pool. Yeah, in the pool. Okay.
You'll carry on House,
and I'll carry it on House.
With apologies, I have to move the rules.
And that's fine, because we are now going to adjourn our work session on 6529, and we are going to convene our public hearing on 6506, the capital construction budget of the Department of Corrections. You're on. Hey, where's the correction book?
I'm searching.
Here, I'll look at it.
Oh,
she has no faith in us. She didn't think we'd get the correction.
I don't think they moved the
thing. Yeah, no faith in me.
Where is that all session?
Hey,
I'm making
the cover number. Where were you for a while, buddy?
Yeah. Well, the players on the team for me.
Yeah, I just dying.
I always let the ball set in, you know.
Hey,
and Eddie didn't even make him vote. He just had him doing the objection and made me vote.
Sure. I guess it's just the opposite.
I didn't want him to have to set in for some of the
things. How does the usually work, though? Is it usually the way to do it?
When you usually send a bill out, it's supposed to be roll call. That allows members to understand if they want to. The way you do with the gavel is by general rules. If anybody disagrees, does anybody have any dissent? Motion. The motion is written out. Roll call. Roll call. Way we've always
been. We're going to roll call out of polls.
Yeah, we do. It's close.
If it's close.
Yeah.
This wasn't close.
But you never know.
All right, attention. You guys better be jumping up and down.
Senator Hatch is usually the morning committee.
Well, he knows more about this.
Oh, no.
This is my worst nightmare. I was having a great session. I left you. clubs about that.
You do not look like Sue Aker.
Chris, are you looking for a DOC?
I am.
Are you?
When did that happen? About a year and a half ago.
You're telling me I knew that one.
I told you at the beginning of session.
I remember. I remember.
I thought you were just on vacation.
Well, yeah, she's working for DLC. That's fine.
Yeah. Mr. Cook is hiring all the good people. Who else is he targeting next?
He wants the good people.
Sure, that's.
Well, we're still working on it. Hey, we still have a full committee here. You know, we could do a little work session. Yeah. Let's proceed ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Kaus with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I have been asked today to provide you with the vacancy report on behalf of the department. ORS 291-371 requires that the Department of Corrections provide you with a biannual vacancy report. So what you have in front of you is, as of 12/31/98, the Department of Corrections had 446 vacancies. I didn't put the percentage on here, but the percentage of the total 9799 legislatively approved positions for the department, this is represents 13.4%, or 13.4% vacancy rate. The statewide vacancy rate for the same period was 16.8%. So that's where that stands. As you can see, of those 446, 179 of those are currently being actively filled, advertised, or recruited for, or the position was offered at that time. Remember, this is a date and time, snapshot in time. The 104 that you see in the next column are those positions that will not show up in 9901. They were either phased out, abolished, or planned to be abolished in the next biennium. Reasons that that might happen would be that for 9799, the population management plan had temporary beds at Oregon State Correctional Institution, but with the coming online of Snake River, those positions phased out as the Snake River beds came online and got rid of the temporary beds at Oregon State Correctional Institution, for example. The third column over, the phase-in date later than the vacancy report, it appears that there's a glitch in the program when we got the download from DAS as to the vacancies. For those positions that the department had phased in for January 1st, 1999, and later, they showed up as vacant on this report when actually we didn't have the authority to fill them at that time. So it's just a glitch in the system. So those 29 positions actually as of 12/31/98 weren't available to us to fill, so to speak. And then the last 134 out there to the right is a variety of other reasons why the department has vacant positions, including the fact that we hold positions vacant to create savings to meet budget targets and budget reduction targets. For example, in the inmate work programs, if there are unrealized other fund revenues, they do not fill the positions until they have a revenue stream that can support them. So those are some of the reasons out there. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you folks might have on this report.
Well, let me be the first to tell you, you've got me three-fourths confused here.
Do I? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure it's not your fault.
How can I help you?
That's a basic question.
Yeah.
Now, why do we have this report? What was the reason behind having this report for this department? I haven't seen this particular report in the other budgets.
It's a statutory requirement for the Oregon Department of Corrections, only for the Oregon Department of Corrections and for the Department of Human Resources. We're, at least that I could find in the statutes, are the only two agencies that are required to provide the vacancy report to the legislature on a biennial basis.
Well, I was looking for the history. Now, why are you picked up on to do this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, honestly, I don't know the history of it. It could have been a I know it's been around since the late 80s, but I don't have the history on it, and I'm sorry I can get that for you.
jump to the back end of the equation, again, being somewhat new to the legislature, 134 slots are held open for a variety of factors, one of which you said is, you know, in case you have to find some money somewhere for cost reductions and savings. Is there a percentage that most agencies, in your experience, use for this, or is there a percentage we're using here for this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, I can't give you that on a statewide basis, on an agency-by-agency basis. The Department of Corrections usually does, at least once a biennium, has done for the last two bienniums, a rebalance, which means that, you know, we take a look after about a year and the population forecasts that come out to determine what it might take us to get through the second year. Usually during that process, we look for ways that we can provide savings to meet some of those unanticipated needs that we had when we went through the budget process 2 years prior to that. So that could be one explanation. But as to a percentage or even a percentage within the department, as a division administrator, we were not asked specifically to hold, you know, 5% of your positions vacant. Various divisions came up with different plans to save money in that particular instance.
I assume then this is like a historical number. You just figure over the years we need roughly 100, 100 some odd, and you adjusted, did some adjustments, and came up with 134 as the need.
It's, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, this is a point in time. Remember, this is a snapshot of the vacant positions as of this date. So it varies. I don't think that we carry any particular percentage at any given point in time. I think it varies all the time.
I'm actually getting more confused, but maybe the
number is
people.
Yeah, and I feel very comfortable now. I mean, let's call on Representative Mills and
get there.
In your estimation, I don't know if this is part of your department, but do you feel like there's adequate staff to provide all the services that are required by the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, we meet the daily needs and operations of the department through a variety of different factors, including staffing, and sometimes we have to contract with staff. What you see in here, when we talk about filled, advertised, recruited, or offered positions that are over 12 months old, those are usually in areas we have a hard time getting people in for. Nurses, dentists, doctors, information systems people. So to meet those needs, we do sometimes contract out for the service for the short term in order to meet them. Dave might want to speak more specifically to overall issue.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Well, what about corrections officers? Do you feel like you have enough officers to meet the needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I'm not the best person qualified to make that particular statement. Mr. Cook is here, and Mr. Minnis is here, who's the Assistant Director for Institutions. I don't feel qualified to make the answer.
But you can follow up, Mr. Chair. But is that part of the study that you do? Do you look at that, those positions, and determine whether...
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, in the study, no. We did not do an analysis to say the staffing pattern is adequate or inadequate. We simply looked at the vacancies and why they were occurring.
And what was the staffing pattern for that part? Corrections officers, are they average or
they? Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Do you feel like there's enough guards to do the job? Did you find in your study that there's enough people to do the job? I mean, you're talking about nurses and dentists, and what about corrections
officers? Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, yes, we have an applicant pool that at the time that we need to hire correction officers, we can usually find them very easily. We are even finding that in, you know, at Snake River in Ontario and at Umatilla, that we have applicant pools necessary and sufficient to meet the needs. In addition, the ability for the hiring supervisors to find the people that they're looking for in that field, in that particular field for correctional officers. Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cook, is there anything about this analysis that you find troubling or that you would want to make us aware of? It kind of goes to the question that's being raised by Representative Minnis. Should we be concerned that there are 446 vacancies, at least there were back on 12/31/98? Are there trends or other issues that we ought to be aware of?
This is a funny statement. This is Chair, from my position on the ground.
Someone finally hacked him down the side.
I don't know that I would say it's troubling. I don't, and I also don't think this is necessarily an analysis. What this mm-hmm. is, Senator, is a snapshot of the existing situation. And I think that, that you and Representative Minnis have a valid question, specifically whether or not the Department of Corrections has the sufficient mix of people and the right numbers at the right places to do the job. And I
think, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, sir. Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. The Ben and I are slow learners.
Yeah.
The piece I think that's difficult here is to say in every case at every institution that the mix is perfect. It probably is not, and that's a piece of work that we've been doing for some time. And as we bring on new institutions, the staffing patterns and some of the work that's done, I think, is more sophisticated than what may have happened at the older institutions some time ago. And so, trying to make that balance is tough. Relative to the way the Department of Corrections operates, though, and the general safety of the organization, yes, I think we have enough people. I think you will find COs and possibly the unions disagreeing with that. Oregon has historically been a fairly lean operation in terms of staffing. However, I have said in this committee on a number of occasions that staffing alone is not the issue. I think when you have well-trained, well-compensated, capable employees, the number of staff may be different than it is in other states. The type of institutions that you run with programming, with the work program and other kinds of sort of ancillary activities affect how safe the institution is. And I think it's really hard to argue that we don't have enough employees given the record the department has on escapes from the closed custody, medium, and maximum custody institutions, the safety record for employees and for inmates in the institution. I think that's a better indicator of whether or not the organization is a safe place and do we have enough people than simply the staffing ratio. Because California is a much richer staffing ratio, in some cases much leaner in others, and not necessarily a safer environment. A number of states could be pointed to that are less safe, but have a much richer environment of staff to inmate ratio.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, you're right. This is not an analysis, in my view, either. And what's missing for me is the statutory site, you know, why this report is in front of us. Do you have that history, historical knowledge?
I don't. My history is not any longer than Chris's. As you know, I came in 95, and I don't know what caused this to occur. I think it's the history may be somewhat different than it was in the time that this began, because we're a relative, as you know, rapidly growing organization, so having a number of vacancies that are being recruited for would not be all that surprising, I don't think. The number left open are the 134 positions. As Chris pointed out earlier, we are well below the average for vacancies generally across state organizations, and we're a more rapidly growing organization than probably most, if not all, other parts of state government. I guess I'm not troubled by that. We can certainly get the site for you and try to find, if we can, the historical perspective. I assume it was legislative action for some issue that arose, but I don't know that Sue and Kristen, who have more experience than I do with DOC as analysts, I don't know that any of us can tell you exactly why.
I think the historical context is very important, so your efforts would be very much appreciated. And I would also be interested in the snapshot of the first 6 months of 99. Is there anything about transitions taking place now in the department that impacts these numbers?
Why don't we get you, why don't we get you all the snapshots that have been done if we have those reports. We'll get you what we can to see if we can look at some kind of trend. But we haven't done an analysis on this. We simply have reported per the statute the vacancies at the time.
Okay.
And I think it is surprising to everybody that there are only two state agencies that do this.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think trending would be important too in terms, I mean, you know, as many criteria as you could put in. I mean, work-related assault, prisoner to staff ratios, I mean, anything that you think would be helpful in terms of trends.
Mr. Chair, that information we do have.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Miss.
Thank you, Dave. I don't want to sound antagonistic, but I have one other question. EOCI, you think they have enough staff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, Mr. Arminicus is going to come up in just a moment and have a conversation with you about that. I don't take that as an antagonistic question at all. I think EOCI is certainly one of those areas that is an older institution. Times have changed. Inmates have changed. I think we can balance the needs that EOCI has around vacation and other issues in a way that doesn't necessarily add employees and gives flexibility for the employees.
Well, I have about 30 requests up here for time off for 1 and 2 days, sometimes longer, and every one of them say not approved because of insufficient staff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I think I probably could get you a pile of reports that would probably say approved as well for time off. Actually, and Nick will talk more about this. I don't have the specific data that he's going to present to you. But there were a number of opportunities for vacation, EOCI, and other institutions that were not filled by employees when the opportunities existed. And a lot of this has to do with when people, and I understand this, people want to take time off when the weather's good, when the kids are out of school, when their wife can go or their husband, all the rest of that. But in an operation like we have, we can't have 30 people waiting in the wings so that people can jump in when it's good vacation weather. I think that you would be all over us for the cost
of
that.
This is across the board. This is every day of the year. This is every month of the year. So not just summertime.
Well, let me have Nick come up, and we'll do that piece as soon as we're done here. I think we can walk through that.
Representative Trader, one more question just on the vacancy. The 12 months and over seems like it's the highest in all the different categories. I mean, I think of vacancies, I think, well, you know, that you someone quits or gets sick, and you can hire someone else in. That would be, you know, usually a 6 month span or, you know, shorter time period. And I just was curious why there's so many. And then when you do fill them, it looks like in the next column, only a third are really getting filled. So this is a portion of the budget that you could use elsewhere. You know, you only need to have, like, if we look at agency-wide total, 12 and over, 287 vacant as a snapshot. I understand it's a snapshot. Then 87 at the same time we're getting filled at that snapshot. That would seem like there's, you know, 200 positions that are kind of open and not being used. And is this an area that you can either hire more people or use for some other purposes within the system, or maybe a trend to show if there's some low point way below this that you need it? I'm just trying to figure out, do we have too much buffering here, I guess, is what I'm asking.
You want to answer, Chris?
Well, I'll give it a shot and see how it is. Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, of that 287 for 12 months or over, like is indicated, 87 is being actively recruited for, filled at the time or whatever. The 89 are positions that actually will not be in the 9901 budget, so there would be no need for us to fill them because we know they're going to be abolished. So I would personally take those 89 out of the mix.
Okay.
The 22 are the glitch in the system in regards to when we had the ability to fill these positions because they were not available to us until after January 1st, 1999. So I would take those out of the mix as well. That leaves you with the 89 in the far right column, of which we have utilized some of those positions for a variety of different things. If you go up to inmate work programs and look at, for example, of that 89, 27 of them are in inmate work programs, and I happen to know that 23 of those 27 are vacant because there is not the revenue to support them, the other fund revenue to support them. So that's the particular reason there. Looking at correctional programs, a good portion of those 25, 14 of those 25 positions are vacant due to a post factor that the department has where, for example, for a five-day post, there's 1.21 FTE. Now, as much as we can, we try to combine all those so they make up positions as they go, but sometimes portions get left off because of the odd number, and I'm not going to explain this very well, and it's somewhat technical, but so there are positions out there that maybe have a portion of an FTE left to them, but not a whole FTE. And the same thing would be true in the institutions where there are 12 and over, portion of those are post-factor, as well as looking at financing for reclass packages to change the classification from a position from one place to another. People are on a double fill or a job rotation at the moment, so they're holding the position to accommodate that need. So those are some of the reasons that those are out there for 12 months, if that helps you at all.
Okay. But while you were talking about, say, particularly in the corrections, that but 23 of the 25 had been filled, the during that time period, you're starting from one ledger, have there been others that have retired, you know, quit, got fired? What, is there another hole that's being created? One thing to put data down here to say that says, okay, we've got 25. For whatever reasons, long-term, we've got legitimately 25 positions that have not been filled. And then you verbally represent that a significant portion of those have been filled. Well, during that intervening period while you're filling these 25, have you had any significant amounts of retirements, quittings, firings, transfers, whatever?
Mr. Chair, we have not had the kind of effect with retirements, for example, that the state police and others have gone through. We've had a couple of periods in which we have suffered fairly significant retirements with the PERS system, but I don't think if you took this snapshot at various times during the year that you'd find this report looking significantly different, unless it came right after the start of the biennium or something else and position authority came open for us for new institutions for startup. I mean, that's, I think, maybe the value in going back and trying to see what the trend line is, but it is, in fact, just a snapshot. I don't think it necessarily gives you a completely accurate picture about what the department's status is in any given day. I actually think our turnover rate in a public safety agency such as ours is relatively low. What you do find in corrections, particularly in the first year, is a number of turnovers with staff who really aren't, by their own decision or by our decision, not appropriate for the position. And so the correctional officer series in the first year or so is a high turnover. Generally, the department has a relatively low turnover of positions.
Well, and yeah, at the same time, I'm just looking at this thing, and I understand what you're saying. You know, of the total 130 vacancies for whatever reasons, the 134, you know, 55 of them, you know, or 60 coming out of the institutions. I mean, almost half are coming out of the institutions, which is where I understand you have your most employees and probably where there's highest turnover. But that might be getting back to Representative Minister's question with regard to adequate staffing levels at specific institutions. But we'll wait for Nick to get up here. So we can
sure, I'm certainly not the expert on post-factor either, but that is really a post-factor issue. If, in fact, you want to have a post, whatever you might call that post, for example, the person responsible for the tower at OSP, as an example, and that is a post that is filled 24 hours per day, 7 days a week, it requires a significant greater number of employees to fill that post than simply one individual. And so those positions work to allow that post factor to be in place. Nick can probably talk more about this than anybody else sitting at the table.
Okay. Well, are there any other questions that I'm missing?
Mr. Chair. Senator, question in regards to Snake River, and of course the institution part is the biggest number of vacancies in there. Have they been able to tell, if I look at prisons that have been sited in rural areas, and you can't tell me it's not a lot more expensive to site a prison in rural areas than it is, say, in Portland, someplace else in any case. The personnel there, can you tell yet what kind of turnover? Because it's probably the best paying jobs in town. In that area, I think Ontario and Mountaineer County have one of the lowest per capita incomes in the state of Oregon. Have you noticed that the retention rate that they're sticking around?
I'll let it into the crowd.
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, we do not, or at least I have not seen any data that we might have that would show a difference in turnover rates between institutions. We usually do it on a department-wide basis. So there hasn't been an analysis to show if there is less turnover in the eastern side of the state where we've opened up facilities in Ontario and looking at opening up in Umatilla versus what we have here on the west side.
That would be, Mr. Chair, that would be an interesting statistic for me because, you know, we're having this argument, it seems like, in regards to siting of prisons in the eastern part over the urban part. Just see some of the advantages in regards to, I can see so many disadvantages with the cost of food, the different transportation, all those things that come into play, but your labor force is, like in any business, is a key part of that business. And I think we should be able to, or try and tell, down the road, what the retention rates, how they're better work ethic. We have that, you know, people out there, many of them are farming people, those type of people that know what it is to work, know what it is to get up, go to work for 8 hours a day, and those type things. And it's a very high Hispanic population. I think if you look to that area, because the area is close to 50%. Schools are 50% Hispanic. So, that's an advantage also.
We do have all that information. We do retention rates, and we have that information available. We didn't come prepared to.
I understand, but it's something you should have down the road. I'm not sure we need it.
We did go through a period of time at Snake River. I think we had some difficulty recruiting, but Chris and the recruitment unit and others have done a very good job of enhancing. I think we're actually in pretty good shape in that particular area right now. I think we're finding candidates that we think are certainly capable and meet our needs to as employees, and I think they're going to find good careers there. We have, because of the newness of that institution and some of the issues that have arisen, there have been some, you know, like any new startup institution, there have been some people who are just not appropriate for the positions. The job is attractive, the salary is good, but they're not suitable for the work.
That's what, 30% of your total employees?
I'm sorry?
About 2,700 is how many you're at. Every prisoners.
We're about 2,550 today, I think, sir.
2,550. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I could just comment from the committee, too, in terms of the context of this report, in terms of history, the department had to, in this biennium, absorb substantial salary and payroll increases from within their own budget, and they had to establish a management plan to do that. That was known early in the biennium. I believe that about 30% of the salary increases that were negotiated they had to set up a staff management plan to do that. So the good news here is they aren't trying to fill some of the positions unless they need to. They managed internally. They came in with two rebalance plans. I don't believe that either one of them they asked for general funds from the E-Board. So there was a conscientious effort made to try to rebalance them within their existing resources. A lot of the positions do relate to slower phase-ins of certain beds at Snake River that were not done because they weren't necessary. They chose to use temporary beds instead of bringing on new staff at a time when they didn't need to. 48 positions at the FRCI, IMU particularly, are involved in that. So a number of issues contributed to some of the vacancy patterns, but I think one of the major contributing factors to some of the long-term vacancies was their staff management plan to balance from within internal resources.
Questions? Mr. Chair, just a point. I can remember in 93, when I first started on Ways and Means, and the way that they funded the salaries and what have you, and probably Karen's husband will remember this better than I, because I think he was co-chair. Ways and Means at that time was through vacancies. Barbara Roberts made the brag that she was going to get rid of 4,000 state employees, and she didn't quite make it, but that was changing the base. We used to do, or the old system used to fund itself through the vacancies. We don't have that anymore. We try and limit it and watch it through the system. Probably it was one of the reasons for this report right here. Because of the fact that was the way that we took care of staff, salaries, everything else was through the vacancies in the old days. It's not that way anymore. That gap's not there today, which legislators had to play with in regards to salary increases and the whole works. Today, we got to, in many cases, take it right out of their hides, so to speak, because they don't have any place else to take it.
Mm-hmm. Where do we want to go from here, staff? We jump down to the
they could pinpoint it up.
I think that unless there's specific questions on the report criticized, it would be good to talk while we're on the notion of staffing to talk about what Nick has to share about what his reviews of staffing at USCI and OSC has shown.
Yeah, Mr. Monica's up here, please.
Thank you.
More like that.
We're back to the first
thing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nick Armenicus. I'm one of two assistant directors for the institution division. What's being passed out to you right now is a cost that describes the cost versus the cost of overtime for staff. I believe that was Senator Hannon would like to have a copy of that, so if Larry Nicewander could share that Senator Hannon gets a copy of it, I'd appreciate it. Basically, it just talks about what it costs for one staff member and what it costs for overtime. You look at the last sheet, the attachment, it gives you a breakdown that talks about the biennial cost. If you have to train an officer and all the other benefit packages that go along with that, and then we talk about post factor, and that's for each officer to work to cover a particular position and be ready to go 365 days a year, it takes 1.75. So that's like 1 3/4 persons to be ready to operate 24 hours a day or 7 days a week in one particular position, 7 days a week. And over time, you would have 122,000 versus 159,000.
Okay. I'm sorry to cover this, but regarding the officer, looks like to me the base salary 65.9. But what level of officer is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gransky, we use the second step in our cost comparison.
That is a biennial figure.
That is correct.
Oh.
And we're getting ready to find out.
Second step, correctional officer for the biennial. And this is for 2 years.
Right. That's what we're going
to do. Mm. Okay.
But that doesn't include the fringe practices, which is it all the costs, or this doesn't include the PERS and whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tim, that does not include
the PERS. Got to look down the line, right?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So at 90,000, even it's 45,000.
Sandra, if you don't mind, just in case one of us suffers a brain loss, could you tip your name tag up? You turn down, and I think Senator Adams was...
I never liked him to know who I am.
If I could run down these figures, if you'd like to, I would kind of move over to the question of EOCI and have you look at that.
Is
that okay with the committee? Overtime versus the correctional officer?
Sure.
I think it came, just as a reminder, it came up in the context of Senator Hannon's question about wanting to see a cost analysis. So why can we, in lieu of incurring overtime expenses, just add more staff and deal with the problem? Having not had the opportunity to read this fully through for today, I think what this concludes is that there are some trade-offs. They do have unexpected leaves of absence, sick leave, things like that, where overtime is inevitable. It's just a necessary part of the institution, and the question for you guys is how they maintain the right balance.
And before we switch over to with this, as presented on that last page, it says overtime an officer. That would be for that one officer to cover that 7 day coverage, 24 hours a day. The totals would be the officer endpoint of 159,008 plus his overtime at 122,543. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, can you help me with that again, your question? What I'm looking at is the last sheet. It says correctional officer, and that's 3/4 of the correctional officer's salary of above 90,000. So it's 1 3/4 CO, which would be ready for somebody the standby, the fill-in for what the needs would be versus the overtime for that same person, meaning that overtime money, you wouldn't multiply it by the post factor because you'd have that available when the need arises instead of somebody standing by.
Actually, Mr. Chair, what we're presenting you with is the option. You can either bill overtime or you hire additional employees to cover that particular need. What that doesn't address, and we fully recognize that, is that those people go, quote, in the bucket for overtime or what other issues are. That doesn't address the impact on the employees. It doesn't address the family's impact. It doesn't address any of those things. It simply says, in terms of covering that post, this is the cost, overtime or hiring new employees. And overtime certainly drives some other issues that for employees, it's sometimes beneficial for them to have the monetary reward, but it can be very grinding too, obviously, if they do a lot of that and don't have sufficient employees.
I can answer this one. You've got the officer listed here, and that's 1.75. I assume this is, to compare the two columns, the officer here you're describing is in addition to the officer that would be on, serving the normal eight-hour shift. Is that correct?
We're pricing out what it would cost to have an officer standing by and ready to go to fill a vacancy.
Okay. As opposed to paying that one individual for the overtime. Okay.
Or a pool of individuals, whoever.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there any limit on how much overtime an officer can work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, no, there is not. But there is a rule of thumb that somebody is appearing to be inattentive while they're working either their regular shift or their overtime shift, and they are not allowed to work the overtime.
Who makes that determination?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, that would be the OIC, which we call the officer in charge, which would be a management person.
Now, what would they do if they found somebody unfit to work the shift? Would they have to call somebody else in to fill it then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, that would be correct. It would be somebody else that would have to take that position.
On average, how many shifts in a row can an officer work overtime? On average, how many do they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, I would probably give you an average, and again, this is a guess, of probably two per week.
And that's a double shift?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, it may be a double shift or maybe working their weekend.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Moving into the next handout, Eric.
Well, I guess it would be helpful for them to understand, too, what portion of that overtime do you have any idea how much of it is in the bucket forced overtime that they need to take you out? I don't think we're requiring them to do, and which is they're choosing.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, very nice wonder. That varies from institution to institution. At Oregon State Penitentiary, the majority of the overtime is voluntary. At the Oregon State Correctional Institution, the majority of the overtime is voluntary, but then they have what they call a bucket list, and those people will rotate into that list. And so there's probably more mandatory overtime in other facilities than some others. So it's greater in some institutions than the Oregon State Penitentiary. And most of my knowledge comes from the penitentiary.
What's the EOCI situation as far as in the bucket?
And that's where I want to go to next, EOCI, and talk about what's going on there next. And I think if I could have the handout passed out, I can probably describe a little better than what the situation at Eastern is. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, what's being handed out is the Eastern Oregon. Is the staffing analysis that was completed of Eastern Oregon. What they currently have is 53 positions that are used for relief. And some of the unique things that have occurred at Eastern Oregon is that
we've had some staff, and if you follow me on the second page, that talks about in July and August of 98, there was 14 staff that were transferred to the Two Rivers Correctional Institution. Then in that particular time frame, there was also 6 staff who resigned, and we talked about some of the problems that occur. So, you know, you have 20 people right there that you're filling positions and hiring new people. When somebody comes into the correctional system, there's what we say 2 weeks of DOC training, 5 weeks of BPSST to receive your certification, and only 1 week of in-service, which you call institution-specific training. So it's almost 2 months that the employee has gone away of training. So those people have to fill vacancies, or there's a void in the system to allow those individuals to come to complete their training cycle. After that cycle is completed, it doesn't mean that they can just jump into a position and work a assignment or a post by themselves. There's still mentoring and job coaching that goes on during that first year of employment. So that also creates a void in the system. But that makes sure that we run safe and secure facilities. Also, during that time frame in December, we converted the H unit to a female, house inmates, a female inmates in that particular unit. So there were 17 employees who were hired in that particular remodel, which caused a bigger drain on people going to training. We sent the majority of the people, I think there was another 50 people who were associated with working with the females, and we've asked them to attend 2 more weeks of specialized training. Also, during all that that's going on at Eastern, we have the fire alarm system going down, and they want to take our occupancy permit away, and we're standing there with 1,500 inmates. So to satisfy the fire marshal, they want us to have fire watches on top of our normal security staff there so that we can ensure that we can sound the alarms in case the telephones go down, the radios go down, because we do not have a fire suppression alarm system that automatically notifies downtown. So until that gets installed, we have some more positions to fill. Coupled with all that and what we call a rebalance and trying to create some money savings to ensure that we can make it to the end of our biennium with a balanced budget, that created a big void at Eastern Oregon for staff to work overtime. We saw the staffing pattern where you normally see 600 hours a month overtime jump up to 2,700 hours of overtime a month because of all this activity that occurred during this particular time frame. And again, this is an unusual type of circumstances that would have in a facility, but these are things that occur. Representative Minnis showed some documents that have people who were denied single days off of vacation. But you don't have anything that will say that people who have planned their vacations in advance, normally in the security ranks, it's a year ahead of time so that they can plan to be away from the work site on vacation. None of those were canceled. All those were fulfilled. And so we want to say that if you plan a vacation, you're going to get it. But if you're going to get single days off, we have to look at balancing a budget. We're a large organization trying to compete with the private sector, looking at all the type of legislation that's out there that shows what type of business that we're in and what type of things that we're doing today that makes us successful not only running safe and secure institutions, but how can we compete with the private sector. And so that's what things that we're looking at have to be conscious to when we look at staffing patterns.
Any weeks a year does a correctional officer, is it 2 weeks a year, or is it?
I think the paper talks about there was an average of 3 weeks a year at OSCI.
And what is the average length of vacation you normally take in the summer? I'm going to ask a year in advance, do you like 1 or 2 weeks, or do they generally take all 3? What is the average?
You can take, Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, that can go all the way to 5 weeks. But they have the seniority and the time on the books. But the average has been 3 weeks.
They take 3 weeks.
My understanding.
I have some people in the back room just bowing out. That answer, they disagree.
And if you look at the documents of the individuals who went to EOCI to look at that
particular staffing schedule, they had to go through they go through it once, see who wants to take the time off. They go through it again. They actually went through it a third time to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to take time off.
Okay.
And again, that was scheduled time off for days off.
So if they have 5 weeks to come and they take three, you're understaffed, so they can't take the other 2 weeks that they're entitled to because you don't have enough staff to cover them, and that's a budgetary item. So do they get a remuneration for that at the end of this? Do they get paid for vacation time when they quit the job or retire, or how do they handle that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, you can accumulate as a representative employee in the youth long-term bargaining unit up to 250 hours of vacation time. After that number, then you start losing that time. To my knowledge, there was only one person who has lost time at EOCI.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
How long do you have to work before you get vacation time?
One year, 1 week,
2 years?
Excuse me, 10 or 10?
I was a bit.
It starts. Larry, but I do. Excuse me, that is him. They normally approve vacation automatically, but you are not eligible to take it until you've been employed 6 months.
After 6 months, you get. You lost.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Kim, you start accruing vacation on your first day of work.
Right.
And you accrued as a representative employee. Different bargaining units have different accrual rates. Some of them accrued it with their what they call personal paid leave days. So it's up to 10 hours per month. It starts at that level. So after 6 months, you have 60 hours of leave accrued.
And you could take a vacation after 6 months. Prior to that, you could not actually technically take a vacation. I think that was it.
Correct.
How long does it take you to train? I know they have to go to school and go through training and what have you. How long does it take you to train a guard or those people that work in a institution?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Timms, we talked about 2 months alone that they're away from the institution, not on the job site. And so it's approximately 1 year to receive their certification for correctional officer.
And in 6 months, they're entitled to a vacation before they've even... Boy, I tell you, I wish I could do that with my employees. That's a great program they got.
So I do it nice.
Thank you. You said before that they're doing an average of 2 overtime shifts a week. I want to clarify that that's what you said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, that's my average per employee within DOC. That's what I use for an average.
Okay. And then I guess, then as a follow-up, that is there some kind of standard that's out there in the corrections industry or any of those kinds of things? How do you compare otherwise? I mean, that seems, I could understand it maybe for a police officer if they're working additional cases or some of those kinds of things, but pretty, you know, I don't want to say 9-to-5-ish because there's all kinds of different, but I mean, they show up on a regular basis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, it's a little more complicated than that. If you have reports you need to write, you're eligible for some overtime. If you have a cell extraction and somebody who's uncooperative, you have overtime that may arise from that. You have somebody who has an emergency that needs to go downtown on a hospital to receive medical attention. You'll have overtime accrual. You have a disturbance. You have a crime scene within your institution. And the list can go on as far as what type of consequences or issues that could result in overtime.
I think Nick also mentioned in at least one of the documents we were doing on EOCI, Representative Packer spoke to influenza at EOCI for a period of time. So there are situations in a closed environment like that where there's a tremendous amount of sickness that moves around from the institution.
Senator Quirley, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you very much. A question for Mr. Cook and Mr. Arminicus. We have a memo in front of us from Brian DeLashma, in which he's requesting that the public safety sub, from the public safety sub, that more correctional officers be added to staff the emergency 10 by using a portion of the overtime budget from the department. And if that is not possible, he's asking that we require the Department of Corrections to report to the E-Board within 6 months on their plan to reduce overtime costs and better plan for vacation and training leave staffing. That's the fourth paragraph. Would you comment on this request?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley,
let me try that first.
I'm handing out a analysis that is attached to that request from Brian that talks about the overtime at the Oregon State Penitentiary. On the back side of that shows you that the reason for those vacancies were, for those particular 3 days, were hospital watches, and we had 9 staff members on the 15th and 8 staff members on the 16th and 17th. We had vacant towers, and the towers are, because of the electronic perimeter system, is inoperative at this point, so we're placing towers on graveyards to...
You said on the back of...
Larry, did you give Senator Gordley a handout?
On the back of that is what you're referencing.
Thank you.
So those are the two primary top ones. You see sick leave, you see vacation days off, you see operation of the industry's laundry on one particular day, and then you see court subpoenas, you see funeral emergency leaves, you see light duty assignments, you see military leave. Those add up to those vacancies that were talked to on the AOC. Some of them are greater than what he put on the front sheet. As you see that Mr. Harkins, who generated this particular memo, failed to note was that we have some post-release in those particular days. The one day is lighter than the other 2 days. The reason for that was because of training, I was told. And those position vacancies have dropped down to 24, 13, and 15 on those prospective days that had to be filled with overtime. If we didn't have the hospital watches and if we didn't have the towers and, that the electronic perimeter system should be fixed by the end of July, then those would have been down to 4 or 5 overtimes per day. To answer the question again is that we just can't have people standing around waiting for people to get sick or as we talked about hospital watches, and it's really difficult to plan for those when you don't expect an inmate that's needing their gallbladder out or appendix out or some type of other emergency situation that may occur. We also have the courts, the subpoena staff to attend. As you can see, there's just a variety of type of issues that go on in an operation this large.
I'll try to answer Senator Gordy if I can, Mr. Chair, a little broadly as well. I think that Mary and Brian have the best interest of their represented employees in mind. I think they also have the best interest of the Department of Corrections in mind, and they do work well with us. I disagree with their proposals. I don't believe that they have taken the entire system into context. I think it's unfair to look at events and to drive the department in the way that it does with the 9,000 difficult, the inmates. We've worked with labor management committees, I think, diligently over the last 4 years to try to improve the working relationship and address some of the issues as it relates to vacation. I think we have not done as good a job at EOCI specifically around vacations as we can, and we're working with the current superintendent to try to improve upon that. But I don't think you take a couple of slices in time out of a year and try to create a pattern of abuse of employees on a required overtime situation and call that the norm. It isn't the norm. Employees generally get vacations. People get the scheduled needs. They're not going to get the 1 and 2 day requests in many cases because this department's growing rapidly. It's facing a lot of difficult situations. People sign on to work in the Department of Corrections in part knowing it's a difficult environment. It's not, as Representative Patrick pointed out, it is not any different. I spent a lot of years in law enforcement. It's no different in terms of the events that come along that create overtime situations. It's a very tough place to manage on a day-to-day basis, particularly the penitentiary, EOCI, and probably OSCI as far as the issues that they address. And I don't know that we're going to, they're going to make their proposals to you, and they're going to have their view of the world. I don't agree with their view of the world on this, and I think what they need to do is sit down with the department, continue to work on these, and we'll make efforts to address what they see as concerns. But I think throwing additional employees at every problem that comes up is the wrong answer. It's an easy answer, and it sounds really good, but it's the wrong answer. And I don't have to restate myself for the 10th time. I disagree with the proposal.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, you did ask, was there adequate funding for the overtime issue?
Their request, as I'm reading it here, seems it's in two parts. One, and Mr. Cook just addressed this one, it's requesting more correctional officers to be added by using a portion of the overtime budget. But then the other piece of the request is that if that's not possible, asking that we require the department to report to the e-board within 6 months on a plan to reduce overtime costs. So is that latter request?
I just wanted to address the already eroding part of the overtime budget. How the post actors figured out, we talked about 1.75 being what you need for a correctional officer. 0.5 of that has been moved aside for the overtime dollars, and that has eroded down to less than 2% right now. And so to take anything more out of that overtime budget would just cause more vacancies, in my estimation.
Senator, I'm just going to jump in again. Maybe I should just keep my mouth shut here. But Nick, I think, pretty adequately pointed out what the situation is with the cost of employees and the cost of overtime. And the events that drive overtime are going to continue, and they're probably going to increase. We have older institutions. We have a $75 million deferred maintenance bill sitting out there. So when things go wrong, our only ability is to try to work around that. In the case of the fire suppression system, or in the case of the electronics at OSP for the detection of escape attempts, our only choice is to put staff on that, and the only way to do that is to use overtime to do it. Life's not going to be easier for DOC employees or department administration or anybody else in the future, I don't think, and we're going to use more overtime, and we're going exactly the wrong direction as far as overtime need. I mean, it's one of those decisions people have to make when they come to work in the DOC is, do I want to work some overtime? Is this something that's tolerable for me or my family? If it's not, there are lots of other options. But people are working hard, and I don't want that to be the case, that families are penalized or the employees penalized, but it is the reality in this environment, and I don't think it's going to change.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me interject real quick. At one point, I believe, Mr. Marcus, you indicated that overtime is up considerably over what it had been, $1,700 versus $600 or something like that.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and that was at DOCI, Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution, that is correct.
Then, following what Mr. Cook was just saying, Mr. Cook seemed to indicate that, well, that might become the new norm, or maybe expect it to go back down to $600 in the near future.
Mr. Chair, if it's the new norm, we're broke. We can't run at that kind of overtime. Those were situations, Nick showed you, I think, three or four situations that occurred almost simultaneously, and I don't think that's the everyday event, but things are going to come along. I mean, we will have more failures in the physical system, I suspect, and if that's fire suppression or other things, it's going to require work. We, with the number of inmates we're adding, we're probably going to have more cell extractions. We're having more about Measure 11 offenders every day being added, more difficult, more violent offenders, more cell extractions, more overtime to write reports, more issues around incidents that occur. Overtime is shrinking in terms of what we have, and it's probably growing in terms of what our need will eventually be.
Question, if I may. Do you see then that you indicate you have 53 relief positions on, at this point in time to kind of help take up some of the slack to try and balance the overtime, employee stress, and need? Do you see those increasing then as perhaps some of the needs increase given the nature of the work and the maintenance? And
Mr. Chairman, at EOCI, what is going on there also is that the first 4 months is used for in-service training so that every employee receives 40 hours of in-service training. That particular time period is over with, which allows 18 or more reliefs to be used just for that relief and for allowing people to take time off. So will it grow or will it shrink? We really cannot tell you. We hope it's a shrink. That's what we're shooting for. But as Mr. Cook articulated, if the fence goes down or we have a large number of suicide watches, those are things that are really hard to govern what's going to occur with inside the facility.
Representative Patrick.
Thanks. I was trying to look at this the post-vacancies piece that was on the back.
Yeah.
And I guess my concern is, and I know this is only a short snapshot in time, but I assume your shift RFMs are your fill-in people that you schedule for. Is that what those are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, that is correct.
And I guess my concern is if I look at the vacation days off on May 15th, and I would assume that military leave, I mean, it wasn't someone that was called to duty, I would assume that that's something that they at least tell you ahead of time. Those add up to 8. So you've already overfilled your RFM piece, especially if you're approving things, trying to approve things 2 weeks in advance. So you're already one over, and I don't know how long have your tower systems been down prior to May 15th.
Mr. Chairman, the tower system has been down about 4 months prior to this date.
So there's 3 additional people that you knew about. So that would be 11. As I counted, 11 people that you already knew would be gone from the Oregon State Penitentiary, just in terms of scheduling previously. And then I don't know what I would assume you have some kind of sick leave trend, but, you know, if you already had 11 that you knew were gone and you only had 7 positions for RFM positions, that concerns me. And then I go to the 16th, and I guess there's 12 or 6 other positions.
Mr. Chairman,
I compare the RFM, and, you know, then I continue to do that, and it doesn't even look like we're trying to fill for, you know, if you average 5 or 6 people that are sick a day, or you know that there's a couple hospital watches usually every day, I would assume that these are common occurrences. And so I'm dismayed and feel like there may be some justification based upon what's gone on. If you already knew that 11 people were going to be gone, if you knew 4 months ahead with the electronic fees, your vacation days were 6, which I assume you approved at least 2 weeks in advance, and your military leave days, I would assume you approved at least 2 weeks in advance. You're not even filling for those positions to meet up to the, you know, the sick leave, which you're going to have on a regular basis, or hospital watches, which you're going to have. I hope they don't occur every day, but maybe they do. I mean, I don't know, and as I said, this is just a quick snapshot, but that's my concern, and that's why I think that they have some merit. So if you could answer maybe how that all fits together, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, as you can see, that 7 is not the norm for your relief, and I was told that there was some special training that went on that particular week, which caused that to go down on that Sunday that day of event had occurred. And also that the military leave was not, RFM is not normally covered. It's covered by overtime, this agreement they've had with the union that it would not take a block of a relief factor. And so they're using overtime for the military coverages.
Andrew, just why would you agree to pay overtime if they're on the
That was part of the union negotiation?
Correct. They would not be part of the slot that was used for the relief formula. And that's if there isn't free technical. If there's not all normal slot coverage for the military relief. And that is something that occurs from time to time. I mean, we approve that and try not to exceed the number of people that we normally have for the RFNs. But for this particular day, there was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I have to also assume that these days weren't picked because they reflected positively on the situation.
That's what I started out, that's what I prefaced my comment with, so I don't, you know, I don't know, but I'm saying just from these days, it appears like you're pretty thin on your RFM, but also, you know, and also if your contract is negotiated that you can't cover the military leave with RFMs, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me why you would negotiate why your contract would be negotiated that way. And
I would
tell the people on the other side of your contract negotiations, I think that whoever did that is unconscionable to do that.
Well, before we get into this exciting discussion, we're going to go into a floor discussion here pretty soon, so I can maybe have LFO kind of wrap up this segment, and then if parties want, maybe have people come back to next go around and more discussion if need be. And that's maybe to help after we get some of the trend information and maybe a better view of, you know, not just a few set dates, what the overall look might be.
Chair, depending on we were going to talk about this issue during work session, but I think one of the things that we hope to see do in wrap up would be to just ask Dave to speak to what you would like to see as be the remedy to the concerns the committee has at this time, a preferred method, if you will, from the department's perspective of addressing some of the concerns with staff. Would it be through implementation of your new post-release review of post-release budgeting system, you know, reevaluation in the papers that Nick handed out, and even indicated that acknowledged that there was some need to review the vacation slots available at EOCI. What would the department propose to do to address the concerns? I guess would be a question that might help the committee.
Well, Larry and members of the committee, I think what I said earlier is, from my view, absolutely true, that we haven't done all that can be done at EOCI to resolve the vacation issue, and EOCI has a particular number of problems, as do all the institutions. It's a particularly difficult one as it relates to vacation, I think. Our goal has been to look at the way posts are assigned. We've asked all the institutions to look at their staffing patterns, not simply talk to us about the number of staff they have, but look at the way that they assign the RFM and the way they look at the post assignments. We're going through a modification of what was a package system that's been in existence for some period of time on how to factor posts and how to deal with post issues, do something that's more, I heard this quoted the other day from somebody, organized to try to fit, you know, the way we do business and try to better serve both the institutional need and the employee need. I don't know if there's much more wrap-up. It's all of what we've said, I would just be repeating. I think we've got some strategies to deal with this. If people want to budget note us and require us to come back and report on where we are at some point in the future, I think that's certainly appropriate to do that. This is a cooperative effort. It takes the effort of the department and the unions to sit down and try to work through issues. I think if the facts were really out there, there are a number of positions for vacations that go begging every year that don't get filled. There are opportunities to take vacations. They may not be the farm opportunities. They may not meet everybody's needs. It may not be that you get contiguous vacations of 2 or 3 weeks at a time, but that's probably not the norm for most employees around this state either. So I think there are a number of options that we've got, and we need to work on those. And I just frankly don't believe this is a setting to debate how we ought to be doing business around these issues, and it requires a lot more sit down at the table and work through this as opposed to sort of throwing it open to a lot of confusing facts that are, you know, maybe not helpful on this. And I'm a little tuned up about this because I don't think this is the way that we need to address this issue. So it's, you know, we'll get at this, and if you think we need to be held accountable and I need to be held accountable for people's vacations, that's fine, and I'll step up to that. and we'll ensure that happens. But as Nick said, we busted our pick at EOCI to make sure people got their vacations. No scheduled vacations were canceled. People may not have gotten some short notice opportunities, but that happens. I'm sorry about that.
No, fine. I don't think that's our job to get into that, but I think it is our job as policymakers to decide, do we hire more people or do we go to overtime? And that's the issue I think we're trying to grapple with here, and appreciate both sides' colorful description of what's going on, and more information will make a better decision.
One last question. Representative Patrick,
sure. Dave, I'm just interested to know what's been, I realize that sometimes people come to the legislature and sometimes people come to management. Sometimes I just wondered if this issue had been addressed. Have you and the labor unions addressed this issue? Have you met on it? How much time has been spent on it? So I can make some kind of determination whether we need, you know, how we address it or what needs to be done. I'm actually interested to know what kind of negotiations you've engaged in to try and resolve these issues.
That's a good question, and that I have dealt with. Again, we have failed as it relates to EOCI to deal with all the issues that I think are relevant to the EOCI needs on vacation. And we have not only not done our piece of this, I think, to the degree that we needed to, but we also have had some mitigating circumstances or exacerbating circumstances that have caused us to be a greater problem than I think it might normally have been. But I think it also is incumbent upon those people who represent the other side to recognize that those people with high seniority and in other situations are doing very, very well. Those people with low seniority are not doing so well, and it's a system that has to be balanced out. And it isn't up to the taxpayers to make sure that this all gets handled in a way that has a great number of vacation spots going begging simply because we've added more employees. We need to work with it. We need to make sure that the vacation spots that are there are assigned properly, that the opportunity is missed at the right time. And as I say, I'm responsible for this, and we'll deal with it.
But what about OST? I mean, the issues that we've addressed is EOCI and OST.
I'll let Nick talk about that. Nick spent 20-some years at OST. I think he's got a pretty good inside knowledge of how OST works. And this is, I think, a relatively new issue as it relates to OSP.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, we've talked with the members of OSP. I particularly I'm not in charge of running the penitentiary. Mr. Thompson is the one who supervises that particular functional unit. I've talked with Gary Harkins, who's the union president. We are looking on how we could make this work. We don't agree on a lot of some of the issues on what they're talking about is new positions. And again, you know, we're running a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week operation, and it's tough sometimes to ensure that everybody's going to get the days off that they want. The only thing I can also say about the penitentiary is nobody was asked or was held over for mandatory overtime. When they are held over for mandatory overtime, and I've been talking to those superintendents and to the officers in charge to ensure that we don't hold them over longer than we need to, that we try to cut them down to at least 4 hours, split the shift. So if somebody comes in 4 hours early for the next shift, do what we can do to accommodate people who don't want to be there, who do not want that overtime. That's all.
Any further questions from the committee? Anything you want the committee or wants the department to discuss further on money?
We asked for some information, some trend data, and that sort of thing.
And do you think you can have that ready by Monday, Dave?
Mr. Chair, I think we can. There were some questions asked about the vacancy report that we did. IWP needs to be done. Ben's going to do that today. We run out of time. So we've probably got half an hour of response.
You're the only thing we've got scheduled on Monday. So it was history, the trends, and retention rate. If there's any questions about that, would be your
take up the copious notes. I'm sure
that's all about that. Okay.
So we will follow up on our public hearing. Do we have a public hearing scheduled for Monday as well?
Monday is public hearing and possible work session, if time permits.
And we'll try to get there, but we want the rest of that information as well. We appreciate you. And I'm very glad to see Ms. Couch back in action. She's a refreshing change from having Mr. McGee up there all the time. Nothing personal, bro. With that, we will adjourn the meeting.